A different kind of Christmas for Puerto Rico today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Christmas won't be the same this year for residents of Puerto Rico. Many still don't have power 3 months after Hurricane Maria. And everything, it seems, is in short supply and more expensive, especially Christmas trees.
Doesn't feel right to invest in, I don't know, $200 on a tree when so many people don't have electricity yet.
Plus, why the GOP tax bill could be bad news for Puerto Rico.
For purposes of the tax code, Puerto Rico is considered a foreign jurisdiction.
And later, a special screening of White Christmas in London.
Everyone here either is a dementia sufferer or a carer for someone suffering from dementia.
Those stories coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for tuning in today. A big, beautiful Christmas present, that's how President Trump described the tax overhaul that's sitting on his desk awaiting his signature. We've heard a lot about how the GOP tax bill could affect Americans, at least those on the mainland. But what about Puerto Ricans? They're Americans too, of course. Armando Valdez Prieto has written about this for The Washington Post. Prieto is a lawyer and political consultant in San Juan.
One of the stated aims of the GOP tax bill is to bring jobs and investment back from foreign jurisdictions. So if a U.S. company set up shop in Ireland, India, or any other country, the tax bill contains certain provisions which would make it more expensive for them to continue operating in those foreign jurisdictions. And therein lies the problem.
The problem is that the U.S. tax code treats Puerto Rico as a foreign jurisdiction.
Otherwise, we're U.S. citizens, and every U.S. law applies in Puerto Rico as it does in any of the 50 states. Now, the problem is that the bill has not provided for an exception for Puerto Rico. And since it's a tax bill, in the tax bill, we will be treated as any other foreign jurisdiction.
And we can actually look to history to see how this might play out, because something similar happened in the mid-90s, right?
Right. In 1996, the Congress passed a law to repeal a tax incentive scheme that was approved in 1976. And essentially, it allowed for a number of companies to come to Puerto Rico, invest, and create jobs here. And interestingly, back in 1996, the repeal was done in order to balance the federal budget. Now, what actually happened is a lot of these companies left Puerto Rico, so they didn't end up paying federal taxes. It was really a lose-lose for the U.S.
And did any operations move abroad in the 90s?
Oh, yes. Ireland actually was a significant benefactor. So a lot of the manufacturing that's done here in Puerto Rico is pharmaceutical and medical devices. After 1996, the amount of imports to the U.S. from Ireland of pharmaceuticals went from less than $500 million to well over $15 billion today.
Wow.
And so there's a clear indication there that the shift has happened without any benefit to the U.S. Treasury and without any benefit to U.S. citizens. And that's what we fear could happen again with this bill.
I know Big Pharma still has pretty big penetration on the island. What are the industries, though, that you think will be impacted, and how many jobs are we talking about at risk?
The main impact will be with those big pharma companies, medical device companies, and the local industrial chamber of commerce has essentially estimated that about 75,000 direct jobs in manufacturing
Wow.
are in peril, and well over 200,000 indirect jobs of folks that basically service and provide mm-hmm. ancillary services to these manufacturing outfits on the island.
Armando, help us understand the justification for treating companies on the island as offshore operations. I mean, Puerto Rico is not foreign. I mean, it's something officials and citizens there were struggling to remind the mainland U.S. After Hurricane Maria.
So it's part of a very complicated set of rules, tax rules and otherwise, that apply to Puerto Rico that have been in development since the United States invaded the island in 1898. And so, yes, we don't pay taxes and we're treated for those ends as a foreign jurisdiction, but we also don't have representation in Congress. We don't vote for president. And these have been, I think it's important to point out a number of them, decisions by Congress. It's not issues or it's not legal matters where we have had a good deal of say as to what applies to Puerto Rico. It is simply the reality now, not dealing with these facts, not dealing with how reality has shaped up for Puerto Rico and the U.S., I think will continue to have detrimental effects for the island.
That's Armando Valdez Prieto in San Juan. He's a lawyer and political consultant. He's also the former director of Puerto Rico's Office of Management and Budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
For many Puerto Ricans, Christmas is usually a very big deal. It often gets started in November.
It is okay to have Thanksgiving in front of your Christmas tree already, and then we extend Christmas almost until the end of January.
That's Edmaris Carrazo, a marketing executive who lives in San Juan. She says after Hurricane Maria, Christmas on the island is a little bit different. For example, this is the first year she can remember not having a tree in her condo.
There are Christmas trees in Puerto Rico, but they're scarce and the prices are very high. Doesn't feel right to invest in, I don't know, $200 on a tree when so many people don't have electricity yet.
Did you say $200 for a Christmas tree?
Yeah, they start like on $150 this year. Usually we bought them for $35, $40.
Yeah, well, obviously they're coming from somewhere else and that's going to make them expensive. So your ornaments are still in the box, I suppose. What about just gathering together with friends and relatives?
Luckily, I do have electricity. So this year, it's actually I'm going to have more people than ever at my home. Usually we're like 8 to 10. This year we're going to be like 22. People that usually will say, no, I would just stay home. They're actually looking forward to a place where they can have a normal night.
Yeah, so you're kind of hosting almost a Christmas for Christmas orphans.
Something like that. It's mostly my family and my husband's family. Both our nieces, they're going to move to Florida, one to Florida, another one to North Carolina. So we're childless. We don't have kids anymore in our family. So Christmas is not the same with our kids.
So many people leaving. It's really incredible. And what about Noche Buena, the big Christmas Eve celebration? Is that happening?
It is happening. It's been harder. We're the luckiest. As I said, I live in San Juan, so not all San Juan has electricity, but I do. But there's some things that we usually have, like a traditional meal for Noche Buena will be a roasted pork, rice and pigeon peas, and pasteles. I don't know if you know pasteles.
I do. I was going to ask you about the pasteles. It's kind of Puerto Rican tamales.
Even if you buy them with time on advance, that's usually what we do. We order them on advance, and then we froze them. But if you froze them, you lost them because you have no electricity. And now there are no plantains. It's like impossible to find plantains on the island. So it's going to be pretty hard to get pasteles this year.
So, I mean, if this is the situation with deprivation in San Juan, I can't imagine what it's like in rural areas.
There's still people that are living like across a river that supplies cannot get there. Not to mention people that are still without a roof. So it feels like bittersweet that we do have electricity, some of us, because to be honest, in my office, more than the half of the people, they don't have electricity and they live nearby. So it's kind of bittersweet. Like you feel guilty to put some lights on or to be celebrating Christmas when there's so many people not even having a regular dinner every day.
So will you substitute all these kind of gaps in food with music? Because musicians seem almost energized by the crisis in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, like in Puerto Rico, we have parrandas. It's like one of the most famous traditions that we have. You gather up with people in any house. You have like books with the songs that you're going to sing. Everyone brings their instruments. And you just like go to other people's house without letting them know beforehand, just surprise them in the middle of the night. And you scream parranda and you sing until they open.
Well, we actually have a recent parranda, so maybe we can entertain you here.
Maybe.
Un, dos, tres, parranda!
So, Edmaris, are people supposed to be woken up by the music?
Yes, they will sing and touch the windows and the doors until they open. and they're relentless.
All right, you're going to have to really be honest with me because getting woken up by these guys, you really feel, how do you really feel about Puerto Rican Christmas music?
Because the thing is, after they wake you up, you are going to join them and wake up a next house because you go house by house. so you can make another person feel the same thing that you just felt. I think this year in particular, people are going to be happier to have people singing, even if we don't have as much food as we're used to.
What about Christmas music in general? How do you feel about Christmas music?
They will take away my Puerto Rican identity if I say this out loud. I'm not a fan of Puerto Rican Christmas music. I like it in the parranda, but it's not something that I have like in my Pandora station.
Not even a little Jose Feliciano, Feliz Navidad.
You have to love it, even if you don't want to.
Edmaris Carazo, a marketing executive in San Juan. Thanks very much, and Feliz Navidad.
A pleasure. Same to you.
One of the things I always enjoy during the holidays is going to the movies. Don't you? I think a lot of people like this. Mingling with strangers in a theater, catching some good entertainment. It just feels good. But think about people who are caregivers and can't get the time to go to the movies. Or consider some of the people with dementia whom they care for. How can any of them even go to the theater? In London, though, a charity this year has come up with a new idea, dementia-friendly film screenings. Leo Hornack, our London reporter at the BBC, has been to one of the screenings. So lay this idea out for us, Leo. What is a dementia-friendly film screening?
Okay, let's just picture the scene. If we can have the music, please. So we are in the front row, Marco, of a cinema in South London. And you can see Bing Crosby is on the screen singing White Christmas. It's very cozy. It's very Christmassy. There's bits of holly all around the cinema. But there is something a little bit different about this screening. Everyone here either is a dementia sufferer or a carer for someone who is suffering from dementia.
Did the organizers give you an explanation of like what happens neurologically when someone with dementia attends a film in a theater with other people? Like, how is that helpful?
That's what's so interesting. They did, yeah. And the answer, just to sort of summarize a very complicated neurological question, is that film is perfect. Because with film, unlike almost anything else, you can exactly recreate a situation and an experience that someone had during their youth, particularly musicals like White Christmas or Singing in the Rain is a big hit with these screenings as well, because music is one of the very last things to go. Very often when people have lost their ability to use language, lost their ability to form new memories, music and hearing music can take them back to a place where they can still communicate. I spoke to one of the carers. Her name is M. And she was there with her mother, who is a dementia sufferer. Em, explain to me why these screenings work so well for her and her mother.
It's what they remember from the past. Yeah. So films like Elvis, Singing in the Rain, we would have watched at home when we were kids.
Do you find it difficult to kind of go to events or do things outside the house as the two of you?
It's becoming harder because not everyone will look at her as I see her, that she's got an illness. You know, if she dresses funny because she's dressed herself and it's not colour coordinated, you know, they're nudging each other and like, look at her, and then I feel sorry for her, you know, and it does become, she's become like a child, if that makes sense, yeah.
I mean, Leo, just kind of normalizing this activity of going to the movies, I mean, it sounds like it could have benefits all year long. Is this an event the organisers are just doing at Christmas?
It is all year long, and they are rolling it out across Britain. I mean, just as in America, Britain is a society where more and more people are going to be dementia sufferers or carers for dementia sufferers. And I found it really moving going to this screening, Marco, because, as you said, it's such a normal, small thing just going and seeing a movie. But you could really tell that it made a huge difference. And what I hadn't understood was that, yes, it's for the dementia sufferers, but actually the people it really benefits are their carers, their kids, their loved ones, who can actually come together and meet other people in their neighborhood, in their community, who are in the same boat as them, and talk to them and do something totally normal and feel they're not isolated.
Our London reporter at the BBC, Leo Hornack. Leo, never thought I'd be saying this, but thanks for going to the movies.
Thanks very much, Margot. Happy Christmas.
You too. Cuban doctors help Chicago tackle infant mortality. That's coming right up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. Here's a statistic about the U.S. that you don't hear publicized a lot. The country is 46th in the world in our infant mortality rate. That's nearly three times higher than the leading major country, Japan. It's even worse in some neighborhoods on Chicago's south side. So doctors there are looking for help wherever they can find it, even Cuba. Miles Bryan from WBEZ in Chicago has our story.
Yolanda Flowers has lived in Chicago's Englewood neighborhood on the city's south side for most of her life. And at 47, she's had problems related to pregnancy that are common here. Multiple miscarriages and one child born prematurely. She's had bare bones health coverage. So when a team of Cuban and U.S. health workers researching Englewood's high infant mortality rate show up at her door, that's something they wanted to talk about.
Have you ever had teeth removed or crowned because of a cavity?
Yes.
But not before asking about a ton of other stuff first.
How would you classify your oral hygiene? Excellent, good, average, fair, poor?
Fair.
Okay.
They also ask Flowers if her house has any mold, if she takes vitamins, things that might not seem related to infant mortality, to helping babies survive their first year of life. But asking a wide range of health questions is a cornerstone of Cuba's healthcare system and something the Cuban doctors are teaching their counterparts in Chicago. Jose Villamarin, one of the Cuban doctors, says his country's poor, and that's forced doctors there to lean on cheap home visits and health surveys to catch problems early. He says Cuba's used this method since the revolution in 1959 and says it's helped them decrease infant mortality from 60 per thousand live births to 4.3 per thousand.
Al cierre del año 2016.
That 4.3 number means that in Cuba, for every 1,000 babies born, between 4 and 5 die before the age of 1. That's a bit lower than the U.S. average, but more than three times lower than the infant mortality rate in Englewood.
Infant mortality rates in the Englewood community are some of the highest in America.
Ashish Ansal is one of the U.S. doctors on the project. He says income inequality and lack of access to medical care are largely to blame for that high rate. Ansal says they're focusing on infant mortality because it's a good benchmark for the community's health in general.
Essentially, it speaks about the quality of care that is being provided as a whole.
The Cuban and U.S. team has gone out on 50 home visits interviewing women of reproductive age. It's a rare partnership between the University of Illinois and the Cuban government, funded by the Kellogg Foundation. Kathy Tosas-Milligan, a U.S. epidemiologist with the project, says they're after useful information that doesn't always come up during a 10-minute doctor's appointment.
What we're hoping to discover is issues within Englewood that are truly impacting the health that are not being collected, that the doctors cannot see when they come and see the woman and prescribe her one pill.
The idea is that instead of the typical American way of waiting until one of the women from the neighborhood shows up at the hospital, the local clinic could reach out beforehand, before anything goes wrong. Many of the questions the team asked Yolanda Flowers aren't the kind that would come up in, say, a new mother's hospital visit. For example, Villamarin, the Cuban doctor, asks when she's last been to the dentist. I wondered why.
How does visiting a dentist have anything to do with infant mortality?
Yeah, there is a relation between the dental health and the prematurity, you know?
Premature baby.
Premature baby, yeah.
Research connects gum disease to premature births. That fact hit home for Flowers, who's lost four pregnancies and hasn't been to a dentist in almost 20 years.
Sometimes the answers are in the most unexpected places.
Tosas-Milligan, the U.S. epidemiologist, says she and her team looked across the U.S. for a model. But she says they kept hearing about Cuba because that country does so much without the expensive medical procedures that much of the U.S. system leans on, but cash-strapped people in Englewood often go without.
Sometimes it's hard for us to face some of our realities that as much as we spend, that we have somehow not been successful at improving or keeping our babies alive.
Tosas-Milligan wants to scale this approach to address other key health problems in underserved parts of Chicago. And experts say that this is possible, but would take a lot more investment. Marianne Mercer is with the University of Washington School of Public Health. She's studied Cuba's low infant mortality rate. She says Cuba's success rests on a whole lot more than just asking questions.
Well, it's an interesting idea, and I wish it were as easy as it sounds, because the Cuban health system and the Cuban health care system are so very different from ours.
Mercer points out that although Cuba is poor, it makes more resources available to at-risk women. In Cuba, she says, a pregnant woman who isn't getting enough to eat will be fed because of government-issued rations. A woman in the same situation in Englewood might get more attention under this pilot project, but her groceries would have to come from somewhere else.
So it's nice to say, yeah, we could do it if we were willing to expend the resources, but I'm not convinced that we could. Would. I'm not convinced we would.
The U.S. health workers tackling this new approach say they get how hard it would be to make what happens in Cuba happen here in Chicago. But they think it's worth trying. For The World, I'm Miles Bryan in Chicago.
Miles' story was made possible with support from Kaiser Health News. Don't despair, friends. There are sunnier days ahead. Today is the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere, the shortest day and the longest night of the year. In Fairbanks, Alaska, just 120 miles south of the Arctic Circle, there's a gorgeous view as the sun makes an appearance for just over 3 hours. The winter solstice is celebrated in many parts of the world, think festivals and bonfires. But the summer solstice is also a big thing for us, and that's what's happening today in the Southern Hemisphere, the summer solstice, because below the equator, it is summer and the weather is warm and sunny, and they're having their longest day of the year. Kira Long is a reporter based in Rio de Janeiro. So how do Brazilians celebrate the summer solstice, Kira?
So not a lot particularly happens for this specific day in Brazil, but it is pretty hot and sunny. Summer is finally arriving. Temperatures in Rio are about 40 degrees Celsius at the moment. So a lot of people in Rio and in other coastal cities will be going to the beach if they can. Brazilians do also love any excuse to party. So there might be small celebrations in towns outside of Rio. I know, for example, last year, a town called Petrópolis, which is maybe an hour from the main city in Rio, had a very big celebration with about 90 bands, lots of live music, lots of beer. And I know that there are other celebrations that happen in other small towns of a similar sort of vibe. So again, lots of beer, lots of live music.
And so Brazilians do consider this day the start of the summer, right?
What I've tended to notice is that for Brazilians, the summer starts when the temperatures start rising. I don't feel like there's a specific day. I think because there are a lot of public holidays and other religious holidays in Brazil that are very important, that are days off, those tend to take precedence.
So when it's summer in the Northern Hemisphere, like June 21st, it'll be winter down there. Does the winter solstice hold any significance?
The winter solstice is much more popular in Brazil. There's a very, very big month-long celebration in June called Festa Junina, which was traditionally celebrated, again, by a lot of agricultural communities across Brazil. Today, in big cities like Rio and like São Paulo, that just means lots more celebrations. There's also a lot of saint commemorations in that month, which coincides quite nicely. So that whole month, despite being rainy and being cold, there tend to be quite a few festivities and a lot of traditional music. And yes, lots more beer.
Tell me about your day today and what are you going to do tonight?
My day today, I will probably continue working, but I will definitely be going for drinks this evening with some friends.
Kira Long, a reporter in Rio de Janeiro, where it's the summer solstice. Kira, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Marco Werman. President Trump's tough talk on trade worries some people in Arizona whose jobs rely on trade with Mexico.
These are high-wage jobs that are associated with trade with Mexico. And if NAFTA were blown up in the way that the president has threatened to do so, that would really, really hurt us here locally.
Why Arizona businesses support NAFTA, that's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It seems the word of the day is taxes, and that's what we're going to focus on for a bit right now. Specifically, the corporate tax rate cut for American companies in the bill passed yesterday by Congress, and how we compare to other countries' corporate taxes. The World's Jason Margolis is our resident economics expert and joins me now in the studio. So, Jason, the U.S. corporate tax rate is being cut from 35 to 21%. Where did we stand compared with the rest of the world, and where are we now?
So we were extremely high. We were on an outlier. And now we're somewhere in the middle. We're competitive with other European countries.
And there's also a one-time tax repatriation holiday for corporate profits overseas. Tell us what that is.
American companies that have stored their profits overseas can bring it back now and are taxed one time at 8% or 15.5%, depending on the type of income it is.
Right. So the big promise overall is that lower taxes for corporations will mean more money is going to stay in the U.S., creating jobs and raising wages. Is that going to work?
So let's go back to that one-time repatriation. So they tried that under President George W. Bush in 2004. There was a tax holiday for corporations. They brought back the money. And what did they do with all that money?
Yeah, what did they do with
they
all that money?
They gave it to the shareholders in terms of dividends. In fact, the companies that brought in a lot of money laid off workers. So the promise that wages are going to go up and we're going to hire new workers, what is more likely to happen if you look at what has happened, the shareholders are going to make money and the CEOs are going to make more money as well. Now, it is going to be a much more competitive environment for American companies.
So even with the corporate tax cut, do incentives still remain for corporations to shift their businesses overseas?
Absolutely. So I'm looking at a chart right now of the tax rates across the world. Our rate is still going to be higher than Ireland, for example. So why not move your business to Ireland? And the answer to that is think of it as a state. So Wyoming has zero corporate income tax. So why doesn't a Massachusetts company relocate to Wyoming? Well, there's lots of factors. There's quality of life. There's transportation. There's energy costs. Taxes are but one part of it.
You're saying companies would be more comfortable in Dublin as opposed to Cheyenne?
I'm not saying that.
Yeah, and is there anything to suggest in the new GOP tax bill that foreign companies might actually come here?
Absolutely. The United States has become a much more attractive place to do business pretty much overnight, and no one's discounting that. Yeah, we could see more foreign companies setting up shop, but we'll see.
So taxes are part of a much bigger conversation about how to stimulate the economy and bring back jobs to the U.S. You were just in Arizona reporting on trade, right?
Yeah, I was. So that's the other part of President Trump's strategy to bring back jobs to the U.S. He got elected in no small part because of his disdain for trade deals. He often called NAFTA the worst trade deal ever, and he vowed to rip up the 23-year-old agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Now, negotiators from those three countries have been working for months to hammer out a new deal. And as they work, President Trump continually threatens to just walk away from the table and rip up the agreement. And that has many, many business interests in Arizona pretty concerned.
Okay, let's hear your story. And let me add that as part of our 50 States project, where we're visiting communities around the country to explore the impacts of globalization. All right, we're off to Tucson, Arizona.
Arizona needs Mexico. Unlike the United States as a whole, Arizona actually has a trade surplus with its southern neighbor. At Cade Industries factory in Tucson, welders build massive tanks and steel silos used by mining and oil and gas companies. Setting up shop here, just 70 miles from the border, it wasn't by chance.
Mexico is naturally a resource-rich country, and we support a lot of mining companies, and so by being in Arizona, we have a close proximity to those customers.
Rob Ossenmacher is president of Cade. He says since NAFTA came into effect 23 years ago, business has boomed.
I can tell you that it's going to be a little off the cuff, but I believe in the early 90s, we were around 6 to 8 million in revenue. And so now we're more closer to 60 million.
Now, Ossenmacher can't attribute that tenfold increase directly to NAFTA. But he can say this about his Mexican customers this year.
I can say that since there's been an uncertainty in NAFTA, our business, mainly this year in 2017, has decreased.
Less revenue means fewer jobs. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce estimates that 236,000 Arizona jobs would be at risk if the U.S. withdraws from NAFTA. This situation has Arizona's political leaders from both parties quite concerned. Greg Stanton is the Democratic mayor of Phoenix, the nation's fifth largest city. He helped open two trade offices in Mexico recently. He says Arizona's image took a hit after the state passed its controversial law SB 1070 7 years ago. That required police officers to demand proof of legal status from people they stopped, who they suspected of being unauthorized. Stanton says they'd been repairing fractured relations with their southern neighbor. Then President Trump burst onto the scene.
For us, it's like, here we go again. You know, we had worked so hard to overcome past political mistakes made here in Arizona, to overcome that, to build a stronger economic relationship with Mexico. And now, not at a local level, not at a state level, but at a federal level, we're facing immense threats to this improved relationship. Make no mistake, these are high-wage jobs that are associated with trade with Mexico. And if NAFTA were blown up in the way that the president has threatened to do so, that would really, really hurt us here locally.
Stanton says President Trump is clinging to an old economic model.
Things are made in one country and then are shipped across the border and sold in another country. The truth is that for so many of the either electronics or automotive parts or aviation parts, those products cross the border multiple times before they are finished. That's the modern international economy.
Case in point, a new California-based car company, Lucid Motors, which is building electric luxury vehicles to compete with Tesla, recently decided to build a factory just south of Phoenix.
The cars that would be developed would cross that border like 8 or 9 times before they are completed. Those are great jobs here in Arizona. And if without a effective NAFTA, that goes away.
But would it? I spoke with the chief technology officer for Lucid Motors, who said they're closely monitoring the situation. But he said there would have to be very severe changes for Lucid to rethink its entire business model in Arizona. In other words, it depends on what trade negotiators come up with, or what a world without NAFTA would mean for a border state. Still big unknowns.
We've never backed out of a trade agreement in this country before, so we would be in uncharted territory.
Eric Lee directs the North American Research Partnership out of Phoenix. He says if NAFTA is canceled, expect years of litigation. Tariffs could rise and trusted trade programs could be hampered. Now, all of this isn't to say that reopening NAFTA was a foolish move. Lee and most everyone agree that the 23-year-old trade deal could benefit from some updating, especially workers. Don Schumann is with the Teamsters Local 104 in Phoenix. We spoke at the Union Hall. She sits under a photo of the Teamsters General President James Hoffa, taken about 25 years ago.
That rally was in Southern California to bring out and expose NAFTA for what it really does, that it kills jobs in America, and it takes away good blue-collar jobs in America and sends them to other countries.
She says NAFTA is hollowing out the middle class in America and adding to income inequality. And now, traditionally Democratic union leaders are supporting the Republican president's push to renegotiate the treaty.
Maybe some of it works, but a lot of it doesn't. And it's time that we bring jobs back to America. And it's time that we provide for our own middle class.
That's very much what President Trump has said, and that's what he got elected on. So was he popular among the Teamsters or no?
I think that when it came to trade and when it came to NAFTA, I do believe that President Trump has the right intention. That's all I want to say about him.
It's a complicated trade deal, a complicated renegotiation, and a complicated man at the center of it all. Add it all up, for a border state that relies heavily on trade with Mexico, anxiety is high. For The World, Jason Margolis, Phoenix.
Speaking of trade, let's return to our ongoing look at what life is like for the people who make our clothes. Our Across Women's Lives desk has been focusing on this for the past few weeks. Garment workers are overwhelmingly women, and most of them work in factories in places like Bangladesh. That's where more than 1,100 people were killed in a factory collapse in 2013. Since then, there have been two separate efforts to improve worker safety at factories doing business with Western retailers. One of those efforts comes from Europe. It's called the Accord for Fire and Building Safety in Bangladesh. It's been signed by retailers like H&M and Primark. The other is called the Alliance for Bangladesh Worker Safety, and it includes 28 American retailers like Kohl's and Old Navy who rejected the European Accord. Jim Moriarty is a president of the Alliance and a former U.S. ambassador to Bangladesh. I asked him why the U.S. retailers had not signed on to the European effort.
The U.S. retailers looked at the contents of the agreement and said, well, wait a sec, under U.S. law, this would make us vulnerable for actions that occurred in Bangladesh over which these companies could not expect to have any realistic control. So it was a question of fear of lots of litigation over topics that they could not affect.
So it has been roundly criticized, the Alliance has been roundly criticized as not having the same strength as the Accord. Let's hear from Rob Ways. He's the Accord's executive director, and he's explaining the difference, as he sees it, between the Accord and the Alliance.
The Accord is an agreement that was negotiated between global unions and global companies. And the global unions and the global companies have an enforcement mechanism in the agreement that culminates with binding arbitration. And the alliance is a unilateral corporate initiative.
So, Ambassador Moriarty, what would you say in response to that?
Well, I think a corporate initiative isn't a bad thing. I think that all initiatives should be judged on their results. Look at the factories we've remediated. We're up to 262 that have finished their corrective action plans. We've trained 1.5 million workers. We have a 24-hour-a-day helpline that last month got 8,000 phone calls. So we're working effectively on the ground.
What kinds of things are you seeing on the ground in terms of change?
We've done structural retrofitting in a large number of factories. We've provided fire escapes. We've basically taken a bunch of factories that were not in very good shape and turned them into safe factories that would match most of the supply countries anyplace in the world.
So for people who are hearing this interview in the days ahead of Christmas, how can you give them comfort that the people making the things they're buying are safe and manufactured safely?
Well, you know, we've been at this for 4.5 years and not a single worker has died in any of our factories from a structural fire or electrical accident. I don't know how we could improve on that record.
That apparently is also true for the accord. I would like us to listen to one prominent union activist named Kalpona Akhtar. She's a former garment worker herself and was one of the leaders in Bangladesh calling for greater accountability after the Rana Plaza disaster. Mm-hmm. She's talking here about concerns she has with the alliance.
We have to understand that alliance, you are promising to do things, and if you don't do, you are not accountable to anyone. The workers, those are working in those sourcing, you know, their sourcing factories, their life in danger.
Do you think that the alliance has done enough to include unions in the safety of their workers in Bangladesh?
We are here to make workers safe, and we're doing that. I don't know what everybody means when they say we're not accountable. We have a legal agreement that binds our members. They've all met the terms of the members. I think both initiatives have a place, and I do think that our results are exactly what we set out to do. We're making the factory safe, and we're doing it at a good clip that compares favorably with any other initiative.
But the bottom line here does seem that a lot of people feel that the alliance is not as rigorous as the accord.
In what sense? Tell me, what do you mean by rigorous, sir?
Following up on, you know, charges and allegations, and that because it is a network of global companies for global companies, that there's less attention to the workers themselves.
Let me give you a few examples. A worker has his or her salary extorted by her supervisor. What does the worker do? The worker calls the alliance helpline. Within 48 hours, the factory has to respond to us and let us know what they've done to correct the situation. We get back to the worker. The worker says that, yes, indeed, the supervisor has been suspended and that the money has been returned. Like I said, we answer 8,000 phone calls a month on the helpline. I would say that scores of them every month are serious, urgent calls that need a response. In well over 90% of the cases, satisfy the workers. How can people say that we're not responding to the concerns of the workers, even beyond the pure safety concerns that really is what we set out to do?
Who inspects inside the factories that fall under the alliance?
Our teams inspect, third parties inspect. We've actually had people come in. The University of Texas did a study, for example, on our worker safety training and found that it had considerably improved the knowledge of workers of the dangers within the factory and how to respond to those dangers. UCal Berkeley is in the process of finishing up a study on what we've been doing with respect to the safety committees.
So you've been at this for about 4 years. The alliance was set up as a 5-year undertaking, so that expires next year. What are the plans after that?
We believe that ultimately the safety of those factories has to be the responsibility of the people and institutions in Bangladesh. So what we're doing right now is trying to negotiate with key partners, owners, labor, government, to help set up the institutions to make sure that the factories remain safe.
I mean, if you let it be the responsibility of the people in Bangladesh, don't we just get back to where we were before Rana Plaza?
Depends on how you design it, sir. You know, I refuse to accept the premise that somehow people in Bangladesh are incompetent.
It's not about incompetency, though. It's about, you know, factories and factory owners rushing to get stuff done so they can make more profit.
Exactly. And that's why you need good, strong institutions to oversee them. What I'm saying is that, yes, for a transition period, there's going to have to be very active outside involvement in making sure that those institutions run well. Over time, the systems do have to become Bangladeshi-owned, or else at some point people are going to lose interest in them.
Ambassador Jim Moriarty, President of the Alliance for Bangladesh Worker Safety, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
28 years is not very long for a democracy to take root. In Poland, we're definitely seeing some growing pains. The country shed communism, you'll recall, in favor of democracy in 1989. But today, critics say that democracy is in trouble. Yesterday, Poland's president signed a bill that effectively gives the ruling Law and Justice Party control of the country's courts. Now the European Union is joining the critics. Poland is a member of the EU, but the union is sanctioning the country and threatening to suspend its voting rights. Lukasz Bluż is a journalist in Warsaw. So this is the first time ever that the EU is triggering Article 7 against a member country. How are the Polish people reacting to these sanctions?
Well, Polish society right now is very polarized. So the governing party is very popular. In the polls, they're about 40%. And their voters are quite angry with the EU. Most of them still believe that Poland is a sovereign democratic country and EU shouldn't interfere. The other part of society are quite shocked. As you said, we are a young democracy, but still all this process seemed to be going in one defined direction. We joined NATO, we joined the EU, and these last 2 years are a big shock for many. Poland now seems to be going in the direction of Erdogan's Turkey or Orban's Hungary.
So you said about 40% of Poles support the Law and Justice Party. Why do you think it's so popular?
Law and Justice managed to combine two things. They have a quite successful historical policy, like regaining the sense of patriotism. And it works. After years of pragmatic parties at power, the ones that focused only on economy, this is the party that manifests its patriotism in a sort of traditional way. And it turned out that for a large part of the society, it works. It could be a sort of backlash after, you know, Poland adapting to the Western culture. I remember 25 years ago when there was a first McDonald's restaurant opening in Warsaw and thousands of people arrived. There was a big support for everything that was associated with Western European or American culture. After some time, maybe Poles were eager to focus on their culture, their tradition, their history. That's one thing. The other thing are big social reforms. So the previous parties focuses on promoting business. This government focuses on the poorer part of society, and it also works.
So, Lukasz, in the U.S., this story is being covered as a retreat from democracy. I myself just set up the narrative along those lines and the rising tide of authoritarianism. I mean, it's a big deal here, symbolically anyway. Because, you know, the history, along with the union protest solidarity, Poland was this symbol of a successful integration of communist regimes into the West. What are your thoughts about that? Does this feel like a symbolic reversal to you?
In many ways, it does. And the paradox is that some people who are at power now, they used to be the leaders or collaborators of the solidarity movement themselves. Well, to be an optimist, this could be just a temporary backlash. But right now, me or my friends, we are not completely sure that Poland's still going to be in the EU in 5 or 10 years. If you asked me about it 10 years ago, I wouldn't even think about it. Now it's changing so fast that it's really hard to predict the future. Definitely, as you mentioned, we can notice elements of Polish policy resembling solutions coming from the East rather than from the West. And that's very, very, very disquieting.
Lukasz Bluż is a reporter in Warsaw. Thank you very much for your time, Lukasz.
Thank you.
The debate in Poland over where the country is headed is reaching beyond the political arena. It's also playing out in Poland's music scene, like this band called Hańba.
Hańba stands for disgrace or shame.
Hańba, and yes, the band's name comes with an exclamation mark. They're from Krakow and could be the love child of The Clash and Bertolt Brecht. Adam Sobolewski, their drummer, explains the name, Hańba.
It is some kind of shout used in a protest or in the political stage against someone who's doing something disgraceful.
And Hańba has a lot to shout about. Hańba Hanba is doing their shouting in the present, but Adam Sobolewski says the band's lyrics were all written by Polish poets in the 1920s and 30s, between World Wars I and II. Lyrics with themes like crackdowns on dissent, nationalism and xenophobia on the rise across Europe, democracy's fracturing. Sounds kind of familiar.
Often people ask us, do we sing about contemporary times? But no, we do not, because we want to bring up the bad things that happened in the 30s and 20s. So if those things coming up again, it's just because the history is circling. And we want to warn everyone that, for example, fascism and nationalism in the 30s end up tragically in the biggest war the world has ever seen. So in some way, you can interpret that what we do is sing. Indirectly, we sing about something that is happening now.
Wojna! Bardzo prosimy na to jak na lato!
There are other chilling echoes of the past in Hanba's music, like this song called Puste Samoloty.
Puste Samoloty, which translates into empty planes. The lyrics written by Jerzy Jurandot, quite forgotten Polish poet, and the lyrics itself tells about what could happen in a future war. The future war would be, there would be no human needed, because there would be empty planes striking one another, empty battleships, empty tanks that would be just radio controlled and fighting one another. It just strikes you when you think about it. It was written in 1930s, and just imagine the empty planes, we have them now.
Wow, words from the 1930s about unmanned aerial vehicles. We call them drones these days. It's like those old Polish poets were prophetic.
I'm still hoping that we are still on the path that could be reversed. I mean, maybe not reversed, but the changes are not so deep. So let's be optimistic that it won't happen never again, and what we sing about would stay in history and won't it repeat itself with all the horrors it could bring.
Adam Sobolewski there, of the Polish band Hanba, and that'll do it for us today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. You stay positive, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.
W całym mieście na ulicach strach. Ktoś ucieka, rozlega się wrzask. Już szykują nowy płuć. Znowu gdzie się będą tłuć. Chodźcie, patrzcie, chodźcie, patrzcie. Zabierzmy i demonstrację. Ja mam rację, ja mam rację.
PRI, Public Radio International.